Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, I'm Guy Raz, and on my show, Wisdom from the Top, I talk with CEOs and business leaders about the toughest challenges of their careers.
There's lots of ways to measure success.
Sometimes a company has to bet against itself.
We wanted to set ourselves apart by having a point of view.
Businesses really impact people's lives in pretty fundamental ways.
On Wisdom from the Top, some of the greatest business leaders of our time share their intimate stories of leadership, innovation, and transformation. Stories you won't hear anywhere else. Check out Wisdom from the Top only on Luminary. Now, back to your show.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello, I'm Matt Chorley, and this is Politics Without the Boring Bits. On today's episode, a wave of far-right politics seems to be sweeping across Europe. We ask why and whether it'll wash up here. And in The Columnist, Manveen Rana and Matthew Bell on lessons in leadership from Tony Blair and Nicola Sturgeon. And do you know Phil from Iceland? And don't forget, if you like what you hear on the podcast, you can listen to me live, Politics at the Boring Bits, on Times Radio. Listen for free on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. It's Politics Without the Boring Bits, weekdays from 10. Now, today, we issue an urgent appeal. Are you Phil? Do you know Phil? If you listened yesterday, you'll know that PMQs was all filler, no killer.
This week, I met one of the employees at Iceland in Warrington, Phil. I guess I'm gonna say
this, I'm gonna say this. Phil and millions of people like him.
All right. People like Phil.
Phil and millions of other workers, not just at Iceland. I hope he explained to Phil the cost of his policies. And did he explain to Phil that he'd be better off sticking with our plan rather than going back to square one with him?
I would invite the Prime Minister to get in touch with Phil.
I don't know if he mentioned that to Phil.
I actually didn't expect him to be laughing at Phil. Can you feel me?
If you know Phil from Iceland, do get in touch. Maybe you are Phil from Iceland. We've tried all the Icelands, they don't know Phil. But if you do know Phil from Iceland, tell him I want to speak to him. Can he drop round a big bag of Aunt Bessie's Yorkshire puddings?
Manveen Rana and someone called Matthew on Times Radio.
Ah, Manveen Rana's here. Manveen, how are you?
Oh, I'm well.
Are you empty-handed?
No, no.
Oh, thank goodness.
You ran past the box of pastries.
Oh, yeah, it was my... I don't think anyone noticed.
No, nobody noticed.
But I may have not been back.
It was very elegantly
in
done.
In the studio when the music... yeah.
I thought you sounded like the leader of the pack.
I'm here now. It's very important. So Marvin is here, and we've got Matthew Bell. Matthew, how are you?
I'm very well indeed. I'm very sad not to be in the studio with you. It looks like fun.
Yeah. You should come in. It'd be nice to see you.
I will do. Yeah. I'll pop in. Yeah,
especially now that you have your own sound. I mean, that's... look at little Aston. That's great.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to those for Matthew Paris.
You'll need an accordion or something.
Nice. Yeah, we should get a whole
right,
set.
Right, that's next week.
A whole set of... I'm going to have to learn the accordion by next week. Right, let's talk about lessons in leadership. Tony Blair... we learn, has written a guide to political leadership for the busy aspiring leader to be published in September. He says, governing a nation is, in one sense, a little like being the national football coach of a football-crazy nation. Everyone has an opinion. Everyone thinks they can do it better than you. But he thinks that people need some advice. This book is not an academic work or designed to be comprehensive. It's a short guide to governing for the busy aspiring leader. Manveen, who could he possibly have in mind?
No idea. I mean, it's funny, isn't it? But why, you know, I'm sure he's talking to Keir Starmer about this stuff anyway, but why make it public? And I'm sure he gets paid an awful lot of money for advising leaders around the world on this stuff too. So to make it all public feels like, yet another opportunity to make some money, I guess. But it does sort of sound a bit like one of those you know, sort of guides to being a good leader in business that you see in airport lounges.
That's exactly what I thought.
But then, you know, there's always that moment where you see somebody on a plane with one and you kind of silently judge them. And I sort of think, who would want to be seen reading How to Be an Aspiring Leader?
By Tony Blair.
I mean, you've
said somewhere. But they're massive,
those
books, aren't they?
They are, but not many people want to sort of admit that they're secretly plotting to be the leader of a country.
Oh, that's true.
What sort of person buys that?
How to Get Ahead in Business. Fine. Yeah. Matthew, are you a fan of a how-to self-help business guide?
Well, only if they've got specifics in them. And that's my main worry with this book, is it's going to be a load of management speak waffle with nothing tangible or useful. What we really want to know is, you know, what as Prime Minister, what do you get the Cabinet Secretary for Christmas? And how do you remember the name of the cat? And all these other sort of specific tips.
That's really useful. Yeah. Those are tips Prime you could Minister. Use.
But there, I think it's not going to be like that, is it? It's going to be exactly as you say, those books you see cramming the walls at Waterstones. And they obviously do very well, and there's a big market for them, but they're so boring and actually useless. It's just a load of hot air that will probably make him quite a bit of money.
I remember interviewing Matthew Barzan, who used to be, he was Obama's ambassador in the UK, so the US ambassador in the UK, because he had a book out. And I, you know, basically wanted to speak to him about Obama and, you know, dinners and, you know, relations, and special relations. But the book, it had diagrams in it, and it was all about I can't remember what it was called.
What do you draw?
Like here we are, the power of giving away, how the best leaders learn to let go. And it had like triangles in it, and you had to work your way up down the pyramid of power to the
hope the Blair book has some of that.
And I just thought, this isn't what I wanted. I wanted, and he had a little bit of, you know, those stories in, but I suspect he identified that a sort of a minor diplomatic memoir wasn't going to sell as well as this sort of gobbledygook.
It's funny, isn't it? Because I think we always assume gossip sells, but actually there is this huge market for sort of, you know, Harvard Business School type of analysis. And I guess, you know, to be fair to him, for Tony Blair, when he came in, you know, rather like Starmer faces now, you know, the memory of having been in power for Labour was so distant, he wouldn't have had people to advise him. And, you know, it's often said that he feels he sort of squandered that first term, didn't know how to make use of it. So I can imagine, you know, I imagine there probably are genuine tips, but I just wonder whether he'd actually, he's not the most self-effacing man. I can't imagine him sort of admitting to most of those.
Matthew, I've just found some details of the Matthew Barzan book. It was all about pyramids. It was all top down with all the authority at the top. And then after that, people said it should be bottom up. But the problem is the pyramid. And so you had to get rid of the pyramid and move to I can't remember what the other shape was.
A circle?
Bottoms up, that sounds all right. But what happened to him? Is he now, I mean, I think he's disappeared off the diplomatic scene, hasn't he? So it hasn't worked for him, this bottoms up approach.
No, that's true, actually. I don't know what he does now. Anyway.
Teaches geometry.
But then we've also had this week Nicola Sturgeon and her leadership being sort of, you know, put into question. She got a bit upset actually yesterday when she was asked, did you feel you were the right leader for the moment being in charge of the pandemic? But then also, while saying, you know, she's being all upfront and honest about it, they also said, let's take a listen to this, was about the COVID inquiry, insisting she didn't politicise the pandemic.
You are a staunch supporter of Scottish independence. It runs through you to your very core, does it not?
It does.
Is it possible, do you think, for you to take decisions on any matter without seeing them through the prism of Scottish independence and your burning desire to achieve it?
Yes, I know for a fact it is, and if I ever doubted that before COVID, although I had other examples of doing that in the job of being First Minister and Health Secretary before that, I have been in politics for 30 years. I've been a lifelong campaigner for independence. I don't think in my entire life have I ever thought less about politics generally and independence in particular than I did during the course of the pandemic.
Is that credible, Matthew, that Nicola Sturgeon didn't think about independence during the pandemic?
Well, it seems a bit much. It seems absurd to be accusing a politician of being too political or politicising an issue, because that's precisely what they're there to do. And, you know, it's very... I think it's unfair on Nicola Sturgeon to accuse her of that, because, of course, she is a single-issue politician, and that has been... she's been fighting for independence ever since she's been in power and long before that. And so, yes, of course, a part of her was will always have been thinking about that and how she could play any situation to her advantage. But this comparison of the Scottish response and the English response to COVID and trying to find causes and motives for the way in which she dealt with it, I think it's all a distraction. I think, you know, the bigger topic here and what they should be concentrating on is why she deleted so many WhatsApp messages. And I think that could be the cause of her undoing in the end, is the obstruction to the truth. I don't think really whether she was thinking about whether this will play into her favour for her long-term political cause. I'm not sure that's really relevant, because of course she would have been doing that. I mean, that's what all politicians are doing. They're thinking on the long game. They're thinking of how any situation can play to their advantage.
Well, I suppose it does matter, Manveen, if she was taking decisions because they contrasted well in a PR sense with Boris Johnson. Yeah, the fact that she seemed to wait a week before doing the same thing. You know, he would do something. They'd say, we're not doing that. That's irresponsible. Then they'd do it. You know, politics was clearly playing a part in that. You know, she would come out and criticise the slogan that the Westminster government was using or the decisions that they were making. Politics was obviously playing a part in this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think as the question to her implied, I think it's so ingrained. You know, I mean, maybe she doesn't realise it. I think she probably does. I think her entire core political belief is about showing the distance and the difference. And I think there's probably a bit of sort of just the personal too, where, you know, with her comments on Boris Johnson, you know, we know some of the messages that were found sort of have her sort of describing him as an effing clown and, you know, a disgrace to politicians everywhere.
Yeah. You know, it doesn't suggest that politics wasn't on her mind.
Exactly. But, you know, you can tell that she has so little respect for Westminster. That's kind of her core belief. And any opportunity to highlight that is probably a good thing. And, you know, I thought it was really interesting that she, you know, she, having lost all of her messages, not being able to explain what was in any of them, she did manage to find some direct messages to two very well-known epidemiologists, Debbie Sridhar, who was sort of, you know, like the oracle of the pandemic at the start and who was very, very complimentary about Nicola Sturgeon's handling. So I think she keeps trying to sort of direct people to the, but I was doing it by the science when Westminster wasn't.
I could see that they were
messing up and I wanted to hold myself apart.
Well, maybe she should write a book on...
Well, I did think, like, just on the skill of being a politician, I thought she carried off that you know, her appearance at the COVID inquiry. I mean, I sat through Boris Johnson's and Rishi Sunak's, and, you know, she is incredibly polished. There are massive holes in her testimony where you think, well, hang on, how did you have no WhatsApps? Yeah. How did you say you did when you didn't? How did you not minute any of your key meetings? And yet, you know, her the way she comes across... you know, I can't remember who it was who sort of said, if you can do sort of sincerity, you're made.
You can fake that.
And she just, you know, she was her apology was much more sincere than any of the other ones we've seen. It just, you know, she's very good at this.
Let's move on, because I want to talk about MP safety. Well, I suppose maybe it is also connected to the way we treat and talk about politicians. Mike Freer, who's a government minister and Tory MP, has said he's going to leave Parliament after threats to his safety, includes an alleged arson attack on his constituency office last month. Let's just take a listen. There's a little clip of when I spoke to the Labour MP, Jess Phillips, about why she thinks politics is so dangerous.
It never crossed my mind that the threats and violence would be quite as what they are today.
I mean, she was talking about having a whole folder that she keeps in her house of just sort of restraining orders and threats that would be made against her. You know, she is high profile, but I mean, I asked her, well, is it ever occurred to you that you would stop politics, or if you'd known, would you have not gone into it? She said, no, because I would think that I was sort of letting them win. But there must be, clearly Mike Freer has reached a point where he and his husband just can't live with this anymore.
I mean, I think that makes perfect sense. There was a moment a couple of years back where Yvette Cooper's daughter came out and talked about it, and you realise that, you know, there is, you know, the threats are so vast now in a way that they weren't before, and you have so many incidents where people realise that they're not just, you know, they're not just sort of emails or just tweets where people are threatening violence. You know, you've had Joe Cox being killed, you've had
David Amos,
and, you know, you've had attacks against Stephen Timms. It, you know, it is now something that if you are going into politics, you would have to think about seriously. And of course, the moment there is a risk to you, there is the pressure of that on everybody around you. And I can imagine that must be difficult.
Matthew, what can we do about it? Because is it fair to draw a line between politicians who are getting increasingly, outspoken about each other? Is it just social media that people now feel empowered to be direct, more direct with politicians than they would have been? You know, the age at the end of the age of deference probably isn't a bad thing, but what can we do about it? Who is at fault?
Well, I think what can we do about it? The only thing, and what I think does need to happen now, is we need to start putting money towards protecting MPs who are particularly vocal on sensitive issues, like Mike Freer, who talks a lot about Israel, and you know, it's no coincidence that he feels particular threats at the moment. And so I think, you know, backbench MPs who are brave enough to champion controversial issues, that there should be money allocated to protect them, especially when they're in their constituencies having surgeries, because that's when they're most vulnerable. They're probably safer when they're in the House of Parliament. So I think money is sadly one way of dealing with it. But it is interesting, what are the root causes of this and why is it happening so much now? And I think you have to look at the way in which people view public servants now, which is everything is based on a sort of client situation. Everyone thinks they're a client of a business and that they want customer service. And so they see MPs as, oh, we pay for them. They've got to do this for us. They've got to dance to our tune. And you see this with almost all public services, the judiciary, police, and so forth. But they're not really, yes, we pay for them in the end through our taxes, but there shouldn't be this capitalistic commercial approach to them where you think, well, I'm the paying customer and therefore I'm entitled to X, Y, and Z. Because you couple that with social media and the dehumanizing of so many parts of life, and it's now easier than ever to be a bedroom bully, to be sending messages to anyone you want with no real consequences. Like Jess Phillips was saying, you know, the blizzards of emails she now gets because it's just so easy to troll her by adding her email address to all sorts of things. So it's become easier than ever to be a troll. And I think so the causes are unfortunately very long term and almost insurmountable. But in the immediate real term, we cannot afford to lose brave, intelligent people who are prepared to be MPs and who are prepared to fight on these issues. They have to be protected.
Is there something about, as well, just the way that politics, people in politics talk about each other? They just feel like we've gone from, I just think you're wrong, I think that's a bad idea, my idea is better than yours, to you're a bad person and I'm a better person. That you know, there's malign intent or there is, do you know what I mean?
I sort of feel like in my lifetime, it's gone from a very witty riposte, which would tell you, you weren't very smart, but in such a clever way that you probably wouldn't even understand it. You know, So it was sort of parliamentary debate to a situation, it kind of reflects politics too. So, you know, this part of this is social media and it's the polarization of politics and the fact that we can't seem to have public discourse without people shouting at each other now. Yeah. And I think that contributes because, you know, every day people are on social media and sort of seeing new reasons to be furious with these MPs. And because they see MPs on social media, in the past, they used to seem like they were sort of a class apart. You couldn't really get near them. Now you feel like you can send them abuse every day. You kind of build up that relationship where you feel like you can attack them. It's horrific.
But Matthew, even how did PMQs, was it last week, where Keir Starmer said that Rishi Sunak had laughed in the face of a woman who wanted to talk about the NHS, which actually turned out to be a badly edited clip which was circulated online, and it turned out he didn't laugh and walk off. They ended up having a longer conversation. But then Rishi Sunak accuses Keir Starmer of representing terrorists, was actually, as a lawyer, he was just doing what lawyers do. And you just think of the two people, I mean, fundamentally actually decent people, both Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer. If they're lowering themselves to basically, you know, Boris Johnson did it with the Jimmy Savile stuff, lowering yourself in the House of Commons to the level of nutty person on Facebook, then it's sort of giving license to everyone, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't want to sound like a sort of, you know, disappointed Bufton Tufton from the Shires, but you do sort of worry about the...
Matthew, that's why you're here.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Well, but, you know, the general decline in public standards, you know, it is incredible. And it's exactly as you say, if the people we hold in high office, they can't even be expected to behave properly, there's very little hope for the rest of us. So, yeah, I mean, it's very, very sad. And there needs to be a sort of somehow profound correction to the way people behave in public life. I don't know what the solution is without, you know, harking back to the past. But something has to be, I mean, in all, we're finding this in all spheres of life. You know, you see this, people getting so angry when things don't work, and it is frustrating when things don't work, but you mustn't take it out on the person immediately in front of you who's probably being paid very badly and is the sort of front line. And then we've seen this with, you know, just a classic example of this is the post office scandal. You see the small people at the front line suffering whilst people at the top get away with it. And so there is this, I think, frustration in everyday life that things aren't working and people are taking it out on the people they can do. But really, it's at the top that the problem lies. I don't know what, yeah. I mean, we just have to be carry on writing letters to the Daily Telegraph.
It also feels like it's a bit of a vicious circle. So you get sort of, you know, most of these politicians know if they really go at the opposition at PMQs, if they say something insulting, it'll get clipped and passed around on social media. And that fuels more than the anger.
And
the anger.
People, they're doing it in the comments, I could do it. And then
it fuels it. But then nobody's going to clip up an MP saying something quite tepid.
Well, what has been clipped up a lot is everyone talking about Phil. Let's just have a little reminder. Let's boil down half an hour of PMQs to 13 seconds.
This week, I met one of the employees at Iceland in Warrington, Phil. People like Phil.
Phil and millions of people like him. Phil and Phil. 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 Phil.
I actually didn't expect him to be laughing at Phil.
Now, stop laughing at Phil. We have tried to find Phil. We've contacted both Iceland branches in Warrington. They don't know a Phil. Labour insists he does exist, but he doesn't
want to. That's a scandal.
He doesn't want to talk. Which got us thinking about when politicians cite members of the public. And who better to speak to than our very own Phil, Phil Webster, former political editor of The Times. Phil, how are you?
Good morning.
You don't work in Iceland, do you?
I don't. I think I should speak up for all the nation's Phils, actually, because whether he's called Phil or not, you can imagine everybody running around Warrington at the moment looking for anybody who could be Phil. And if his mortgage has gone up by $1,000 a month, he's probably got, you know, a decent mortgage anyway and probably got a decent house up there. So there'll be people after him. Poor old Phil will not have a quiet weekend.
There aren't that many Phils left, though, Phil, because I looked up in 2022, there were 134 babies called Phil. No, born called Philip with one eye. Slightly fewer, about 20-year-olds with two eyes. It's massively down on where it was like 10, 15 years ago.
Philip without one eye?
No, not eyes, L's.
L's, you mean.
Yeah.
L's, you mean.
If you were born with one eye, that's different. But Phil, there is obviously a history of this. I've got to pick out a couple of these. This is David Cameron in 2010 during the ITV election debate offering up this tale from a real person.
I was in Plymouth recently and a 40-year-old black man actually made the point to me. He said, I came here when I was six. I've served in the Royal Navy for 30 years. I'm incredibly proud of my country. But I'm so ashamed that we've had this out-of-control system with people abusing it so badly.
And lots of people pointed out that you can't be a 40-year-old black man who'd served in the Navy for 30 years unless he joined when he was 10. And actually, that man, Neil Ford, actually came forward in the end and was critical of the Tories' position on immigration, which was always the risk. And then this is, I love this, Gareth. In 2014, Ed Miliband, in his party conference speech, mentioned Gareth a lot.
Millions of people who've lost faith in the future, like Gareth, who's high up at a software company. He's got a five-year-old daughter, he's earning a decent wage, he can't afford to buy a home for himself and for his family. He's priced out by the richest. He thinks that unless you're one of the privileged few in Britain, the country's not going to work for you and your kids are going to have a worse life than you.
Phil, I really remember that speech because almost everyone that Ed Miliband met to show that he was in touch with the nation, he'd met on Hampstead Heath.
That's right. I mean, not the poorest part of London anyway. And poor old Gareth, who actually was called Gareth Edwards, same name as one of the best rugby players of all time. Gareth, it sort of changed his life for a time. He ended up being grilled on Newsnight by Emily Maitlis, and that's that's never a good idea. Just ask the Duke of York about that. And the Daily Mail found a picture of him drinking the most massive cocktail you could imagine. So Gareth had to explain himself for ages afterwards. He ended up being He went to Cambridge.
Does it ever work?
I think it can. I think it can be quite an effective tool. But, you know, if you're using somebody like Gareth, who is quite high up in a software company, most people are already, you know, he's not exactly a man of the people. You've got to do it very carefully. And I think you can't do it too much. You know, there was a period with Jeremy Corbyn, where it felt like every PMQs, he was just bringing up the individual cases people. And it started to feel like it was like the local political surgery rather than the moment, you know, the whole nation looked forward to.
Matthew Bell and Manveen Rana. And of course, you can listen to Manveen every day on the Stories of Our Times podcast, wherever you're listening to this. Up next, it's the rise of the far right across Europe.
The big thing.
Et combien de sang faudra encore? Combien de sang faudra? Eh? Combien de tripes de sang faudra?
That is the sound of farmers protesting in France this week as the backdrop to political change happening across Europe, with far-right or radical-right parties gaining traction in countries including France, Italy, Hungary and the Czech Republic. The hard-right used to be at the fringes of the continent's politics, but fears over immigration and economic security are shaking up the status quo. So today we want to look at what is calling it, what unites parties on the right, and how the traditional parties in the centre are responding. And could this wave of far-right politics wash up here in the UK? Well, how better to find out what is happening across Europe? Put your seats in the upright position, please. We're heading off on Shawley Airways. And we touch down in France first, where, as we just heard, those farmers are protesting. Let's speak to Claire Colcutt, who is a senior correspondent in France for Politico Europe. Hi, Claire.
Hi, Matt.
Give us a sense of what is happening, because I've read a lot about farmer protests across Europe aligning with far-right movements, or far-right movements trying to align with the farmer protests. So give us a sense of what's going on in France.
Absolutely. So we've got a farmers' protest that's been going on for about a week now, with farmers heading on their tractors to block motorways, take the protest to Paris, so blocking the main marketplace here with some clashes with police. Now, farmers aren't traditionally far right. They're more of the sort of liberal, conservative sort of mainstream. However, with, you know, we're going into an election phase, we've got elections coming up in June, European elections, the far right is kind of surfing on the farmers' discontent about a range of things which are, you know, all linked to the European Union, whether it's trade deals, whether it's, you know, the Green Deal, whether it's bureaucracy in Brussels. So that's how it's become a sort of crux point in France, where you've got, you know, the sort of pro-European Macron government trying to battle Marine Le Pen on, you know, with this farmers' protest carrying on.
What do the farmers actually want?
Well, they're very clear about their demands. I mean, they want the Mercosur trade deal, which is a sort of free trade deal with Latin American countries, to be basically shot down. They want biodiversity rules to be loosened so that they can carry on farming instead of putting their fields in sort of in rest zones, so that you can have sort of wildflowers and things like that. And then there's some sort of subsidies on diesel fuel that was supposed to be lifted, and they want those subsidies to be maintained. Now, the government is reacting very strongly to this because they don't want it to spiral. So they've already given in on a whole load of things, including subsidies on diesel.
It's not necessarily right-wing issues that they're cross about. Is it just that right-wing parties, movements are aligning with them?
Yeah, I mean, the far right, Marine Le Pen's far right National Front, has always been campaigning on patriotism for French farmers, things like that. So, for example, protectionists. And now the farmers, a certain part of them are protectionists. They want France to fight for their rights. They don't want an influx of cheap Ukrainian grain. They don't want an influx of beef. So there is a sort of an alignment between the farmers and Marine Le Pen. But on the other hand, you know, they're businessmen, and Marine Le Pen also has, you know, a whole host of economic measures that they're not really happy with. But what's true is that the way it's playing out in the popular opinion is that it's, you know, it looks very much like Marine Le Pen is standing up for the ordinary man, standing up for the farmers. And this is a kind of like big boost for her, or at least they're hoping to kind of ride this through up to the elections.
Clear, it's really interesting that. Thanks for that. Politico's Clear Colcut in Paris. Right, let's get back on the plane. Chorley Airways touching down in Berlin, where we are greeted by more protests. These are German farmers protesting. Why? The Times' Oliver Moody can explain. Hi, Ollie.
Hello.
What are German farmers protesting about?
Well, ostensibly, the protests were triggered by the new budget from the German government, which scrapped the road tax exemption for agricultural vehicles and lorries, and also scrapped the subsidies for agricultural diesel. But the government has compromised on these issues, and now the farmers' unions are raising a whole host of other things that overlap to some extent with what Claire was describing in France. So a lot of it is about biodiversity, the burden of bureaucracy, and a general sense that they're sort of weighed down with too many regulations.
Is it taking off? Is it taking hold in Germany?
I'd say it's been broadly stable. It peaked about 2 weeks ago when there were really massive blockades in the big cities that really brought public transport to a standstill in places like Berlin and Hamburg. Since then, the protests have continued, but they're at a lower level than they were before.
And tell us about what's happening with the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland group in Germany. Where is support for them?
Yeah, it's a very interesting moment because the AfD has revived in the polls, and for the past 6 months or so, it's been trending at about 22%, which would make it the largest, second largest party nationally. And in the East German states, which go to the poll, or three of which go to the polls in the autumn, it's by far the most popular party. Yet it's got a bit more complicated than it used to be, partly because the party landscape has been shaken up. There are two new populist parties that could eat into its vote a bit. And secondly, because of all these various reports of secret summits where members of the AfD consorted with bona fide right-wing extremists and discussed the mass expulsion of foreigners, including people who have German passports that were born in other countries. And that has unleashed a mass kind of centrist protest movement with hundreds of thousands of people marching across the country. So AfD strategists are actually a bit concerned that this could eat into their polling figures.
And is that, because I've seen the sort of the pictures and the scales of those protests, the sort of the anti-far-right protests, are they having an impact in sort of squeezing the AfD support that actually, instead of just sort of pretending they're not there, proactively speaking out against them is having an effect?
We haven't seen that much of a shift in the polls so far, but it may just be too early to tell. One potential bellwether was a municipal election in the AfD's heartland in Thuringia over the weekend, where it looked like it was in a very strong position to get control of the local council in Saale-Orla, but it actually ended up losing by about 3 or 4 percentage points to a mainstream candidate after the other parties rallied around it. I guess the biggest short-term effect is that the other kind of older parties have set aside their differences, at least briefly and on some issues, to rally around this kind of counter right-wing protest movement. And so we may see some kind of consolidation of the mainstream forces in Germany.
Just finally, Oliver, does this immigration play a part in this as well?
This is a fascinating question, yeah, because the received wisdom is that the AfD's revival has all been about concern about immigration after Germany took in about 1 million war refugees from Ukraine and then more than 300,000 asylum seekers last year, which is not quite at the level it was in 2015, 2016, but it's getting up in that general direction. What we've seen recently, though, is that the salience of immigration as a political question has declined a bit recently, but the AfD support is holding up. And I think that points to a much broader, deep distrust in a large minority of the German public towards the political system, towards conventional politics, towards the mainstream parties that the AfD can feed on, even if it switches from immigration to issues like the Green Agenda.
Oliver, thanks so much for that. Oliver Moody there in Berlin. Right, back on the plane then. Grab your duty-free. Do you get duty-free? You probably don't if you're going from Berlin. We're in Amsterdam now. Mark Smith is in Amsterdam. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Matt. It's a short hop.
It's not far. It's not far. It's a very nice journey to make on the train, as I discovered last summer. We didn't need to go on the plane at all. What's the picture in the Netherlands? A general election coming this year? No, last year.
That's right. We had a general election in November. The surprise victor in that was Geert Wilders, the far-right firebrand who's been on the scene for a long time, certainly since I arrived in the Netherlands, and that was, gosh, 15 years ago. He has been consistently underestimated, and this time he did it. He now has a quarter of the parliament, but he needs participation from at least two other parties to get over the line. That's where we are at the moment. We've been promised a period of radio silence while representatives from those parties get their act together. But with a characteristic verve, you could say, Geert Wilders has broken that silence on a number of occasions. Last week, he seemed to be spoiling for a sort of Twitter spat when he tweeted, "We have a serious problem." And that actually went viral way beyond the confines of the Netherlands.
And so is this a sign of a shift in Dutch politics? Is it, are they just a protest vote to you know, signal the unhappiness with the mainstream parties? Or is this a sign of Dutch politics changing, do you think?
Not necessarily. I think he's been a fairly consistent feature of the Dutch political landscape for some time. He certainly has a very loyal fan base. He says things which in other contexts, in other countries, you might think would be completely unspeakable. You know, he's been prosecuted for stirring up anti-Moroccan sentiment at rallies. You know, he said all sorts of derogatory things about closing mosques. He wants zero asylum. Immigration is a sticking point, of course, in this small country where there are typically 20,000 or so asylum seekers from outside the EU seeking to come here every year. And he has been fairly consistent, actually. It was only in the run-up to the election in November that he earned the nickname Geert Milders for softening his rhetorical approach somewhat. But I think the memory of those very vivid, very shocking pronouncements on asylum, on immigration, on Europe, I think they have a long half-life. I don't think people will forget them in a matter of months. However, coalition talks famously take a long time in the Netherlands. I think it was in 2001 when they took 299 days. So we're in for a long ride, potentially.
Just finally, Mark, you did you encounter Geert Wilders on holiday?
You've been doing your research. Yes. 2012, when he was seen as the political kingmaker in another election, you know, he worked briefly with the centre-right party that's been governing the Netherlands for most of the time since I've been here. I went on holiday. I wanted to holiday like the Dutch do. I went to the Dutch Antilles and to a very small island called Bonaire. Beautiful place, can recommend it. Arrived at check-in and saw his name on the ledger at reception and assumed it was some kind of joke that maybe some VIP or other had checked in under his name. And then I was disabused of that notion the next morning when my husband and I went down to the restaurant and realized that we were the only other people in the whole hotel. It did explain a few things. I mean, there had been some rather tetchy looking young guys in suits who kept popping up from behind the palm trees. And they seemed to look especially worried whenever I took my phone out of my pocket. I realized the next morning that it was all about him. You know, he and his wife, who is ironically, you might say, a Hungarian diplomat, they've been together for 30 years and they live in strictest secrecy. They're protected around the clock by a security detail, the ones that I saw on holiday. And that's mainly because the Dutch have an unenviable tradition of killing their populists in the street.
Oh well, yeah, it's a grim statistic for them to have. Mark, really good speech here. That's Mark Smith in Amsterdam. Right, we're back on the plane now. Again, it would be easy to go on the train. Doesn't take very long at all. We're heading to Brussels, where Bruno Waterfield joins us. Where are you right now, Bruno?
I'm on the big farmers project. It's going to use 100,000 tractors sealed off during the course. It's very lively, as you can see behind me.
What are they burning behind you, Bruno?
They're burning tractor tires, of course. So it's a huge protest. EU leaders are just down the road there. They're feeling a bit under siege. Another political crisis going on, the farmer protests, but also splits and divisions over Ukraine as well. So this is a huge farmers' protest here. There are farmers from, certainly from Belgium, they've been protesting all week, Spain, France, Portugal, Poland, you name it, they're here today. This is a huge pan-European protest movement because most of the things, almost everything they're against, almost everything that's causing really big problems in consequence of EU decisions, whether it's environmental legislation, they're worried about the Mercosur free trade deal that's been vetoed by France. Anyway, the EU's decision to allow tariff-free imports of Ukrainian agricultural products into the single market to help Kyiv, that has hammered the farmers. Cereal prices collapsed by almost a third over the last 2 years. So farmers have got plenty to be angry about, and they believe that urban, metropolitan, green, tight, garden readers, vegetarians, vegans, are actually against their way of life. They're quite happy to see their communities, their rural communities.
And is there concern amongst those politicians up the road from where you are, Bruno, about the far right in all of those countries aligning with what is obviously a very angry protest amongst farmers?
Well, I think, look, for our newspaper, for our readers to make sure that we're clear and explain things, we don't really use the term far right. What we're doing is to try and individually describe and talk about each government, because these are governments as well, whether it's Viktor Orban in Hungary or Giorgia Meloni in Italy. We try and describe what each movement is. The term far right has become, you know, a catch-all. It doesn't really explain a lot of the support for these farmers, or even the parties of the hard right, the nationalists, or anti-European populists, such as the Vlaams Belang movement in Belgium. What's going on here, under more subterranean or more seismic, is a popular disenchantment, a popular revolt against the centrist mainstream. You can see this playing out in different ways right across Europe. So after European elections this June, the polls predict 9 in 9 new EU countries, the hard right, anti-European populists, will be the largest party, and in another 9 countries, they'll be second or third. That's a really, really big seismic shift and earthquake in European politics, and it's been around for quite a long time. And part of the problem is, in fact, that the centrist politicians, people like Macron, turn it into a contest. You're either for him or you're for Le Pen, and that really, really hasn't helped. It's really helped drive this revolt across Europe.
Bruno, really good to speak. Tremendous reporting for Bruno Waterfield. Not just speaking to me, but filming himself as well with the fires in the background and the horns and everything. But it was good to be able to get Bruno reporting very much from the front line of that protest in Brussels right now. What does all this actually mean in broader geopolitical terms? Is there actually something going on, or is it just some unhappy farmers in lots of different places? The Times' diplomatic editor, Roger Boys, is here. What do you think is going on here, Roger? Is this a thing?
Well, first of all, I'm also impressed by Bruno Porterfield. My goodness. Well, there's a process going on, isn't there? There's a loss of faith in centrist politics, which is quite broad and is not confined to the EU, but is amplified in the EU because of different tensions, different domestic tensions. So, and sometimes it's resolved by a change of government, like in Poland, and like in Spain recently, but not quite resolved. And sometimes the far right wins, as it did in Holland, but still can't produce a competent government under Wilders. And Macron is, as usual, looking into the middle distance and wondering if Le Pen is going to be his big problem when it, comes to the presidential election in next year. So it's, there are all sorts of calculations going on. But they do, the basic discontent probably began with COVID and the denial of public space, public political space, or the focusing just on anti-lockdown, pro-lockdown kind of protests. And then it's moved, it's kind of progressed, and suddenly we've seen a whole coalition of protests going on. So you've got the net zero protesters. And in Germany, this discontent and some of the far-right drift came from something as banal as heat pumps. So the German government wanted to make conversion to heat pumps compulsory, and that would entail even some people selling their houses because of the sheer cost of the whole thing. So there was close to an uprising about that. But then that fizzled down. The centrist government worked out a way of perhaps repackaging it. But each step seems like a step too far. So you have those green policies, and you have the farmers' discontents, and you have immigration, which, and as far as most of these countries are concerned, that problem has been around since 2015 when all the Syrians came over. And it's not just an immigration problem, but an integration problem. What to do with all these people and how to convert them into loyal citizens, and also not put immense pressure on the infrastructure, the health infrastructure, the school infrastructure, and jobs. So all of these things have coalesced around what I still call far-right parties, but we could call them hard-right, because the centre-right doesn't seem to address them properly. Mm. So,
and does it make a difference that in a lot of these countries, I mean, I suppose in the UK, this is the case, where they are centre-right parties in power, are they more susceptible, or is it, well, I suppose actually, or is it centre-left parties are more susceptible to these problems, or is it just whoever's in government at the moment?
Well, there's two things. First of all, there's the timetable. So European Union has European elections in June, and it has lots of regional elections, like in Germany in September. So all these affect your positioning, and Britain doesn't. Is not in that framework. It feels like it's in a pre-election period, but it's more complex than that. So that's one thing. The other is the economic cycle and the cost of living crisis, which is fed then into everything. So you get different groups within society who feel more deprived than others. And these feed in then to the insurgent spirit that you're getting. And there's a countryside versus city tension, which is also feeding into the popular uprising. And you can see that all these demonstrations, including Bruno's dramatic one, they happen in cities. And it's people, first of all, because you can paralyze a city with tractors, and you can lay siege to cities like currently in Paris. by blocking roads and throwing manure on the streets. But on the whole, these farmers don't have much of a direct electoral impact. They're just natural insurgents who quite often are getting quite much wealthier than they pretend.
In part from the subsidies that come from the EU, which they are supposedly protesting about.
Good old EU. Yeah.
Just finally, then, have we avoided this happening in the UK because we had Brexit? Was Brexit the sort of the release valve, if you like, albeit preceding COVID, but that sort of, you know, stop telling me what to do-ness, taking back control and all of that. Did Brexit have that release valve so we haven't seen, actually, you know, reform going from 10 to 13% in the polls? I'm not saying they're far right, but they're more to the right of the Conservatives. We haven't seen that insurgency in the other European countries, are seeing.
Well, I mean, Brexit was a diversion, really, I suppose, from something. I think now that Brexit has been sort of compartmentalized, it's coming back, those basic discontents, and we will see that presumably with votes for, you know, for the Reform Party or whatever, you know, this kind of swirling electorate of and swirling support, 22%. It's interesting that quite often these figures, opinion polls, for example, that you get for Richard Tice's party, match almost precisely what's going on with the Alternative for Deutschland. It's a different system, it's different things at stake, but it's there. It's a solid 20%, or not solid, but a more or less stable 20%. So you wonder, do we share the same fears as Joe, or do these 20% share those fears across the continent? And could be.
It will be really interesting to see what happens across Europe in the coming elections and here in the UK too. Don't forget, you can get in touch, email me matt@times.radio, or tweet about the podcast on your social medias if that's the sort of thing that you like. But for now, for me, Matt Trolley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.